Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this program we're going to examine the interrelationship between fascism, eugenics, and euthanasia. Due to the limitations of time, this discussion will necessarily be attenuated and referential. Some of the archive shows that contain additional documentation are the miscellaneous archive shows about euthanasia in Nazi Germany and contemporary America, and the miscellaneous archive show The Seeds of Nuremberg. These are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is alcalame@ix.netcom.com. Once again, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email alcalame@ix.netcom.com. This program is excerpted from the One Step Beyond program of January 12, 1997.
We should understand that fascism is not something alien to the United States. Because of the anti-communist, anti-labor, and pro-eugenics stance of fascism and Nazism, many of the most powerful interests in this country, many of the most powerful industrialists and financiers, many of the most powerful political figures, many key national security figures, were ardently and openly pro-fascist, more ardently in many cases than openly. There were also many virulent fascist organizations in the United States that were never denazified at the end of World War II. There was no denazification for the United States. One of the things John Loftus talks about in his landmark book co-authored with Mark Ahrens entitled The Secret War Against the Jews is that had President Franklin Roosevelt lived, that he was going to place many of the key American industrialists and financiers who had backed Hitler in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg. There was going to be something called the Banker's Trial, in which many of the Western industrialists and financiers, including and especially American industrialists and financiers who had backed fascism, were going to be tried for their efforts. We've also noted in Radio Free America number 10, among other programs, that in 1934, many of the key American industrialists and financiers who backed Hitler and Mussolini attempted to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt and set up a fascist government in this country as well. Many of the industrialists and industrial and financial connections to fascism discussed in RFA programs 1, 2, and 10, as well as Uncle Sam and the Swastika and Uncle Sam and Il Duce, as well as the miscellaneous archive show Japanese Fascism, Its History and Significance for Contemporary Americans. Some of the eugenics connections to fascism, something that I've spoken about in the past, covered in the miscellaneous archive shows Euthanasia in Contemporary America and Nazi Germany, and also The Seeds of Nuremberg. We have noted in those programs, and I'm going to touch on again this evening, that the Nazi extermination programs grew out of several intellectual movements which were very influential in the United States, and in many ways, some of the Nazi racial legislation and thinking drew on eugenics thinking and legislation that was extant here in the United States. The international euthanasia movement, international mental hygiene movement, and international eugenics movement, all of them overlapped, and again I discussed that in the aforementioned euthanasia archive show, eventually gave rise to the Third Reich's racial legislation, which in turn gave rise to the Third Reich's extermination programs. Those extermination programs began with the euthanasia program, the T4 or Tiergartenstrasse 4 program. The Third Reich began exterminating deformed children, people who were mentally ill, people with terminal illnesses, eventually people who were simply very ill or very old. And this went on to be extended to the Third Reich's, quote, racial enemies, and unquote, Jews, gypsies, ideological opponents such as communists, Catholic and Christian priests, and others. And it's worth noting that the people who ultimately staffed the extermination camps got their training in the various euthanasia centers. This hardened them to the experience of killing innocent people in cold blood. I have also noted again, and we're going to talk about this evening, the profound influence of American eugenics legislation and thinking on those of the Third Reich. I mention this because with the United States having a serious debt situation, thanks to Ronald Reagan and George Bush, the U.S. was the world's biggest creditor nation from the end of World War II, end of World War I, right up through 1980. Ronald Reagan changed that. We were a debtor nation by 1983, the world's biggest debtor nation by 1985. We now owe more money than all of the third world countries combined. The national debt was $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office. Reagan almost tripled that in 8 years. Bush pushed it up over $5 trillion. Ronald Reagan and George Bush between them spent more money on defense than the United States had spent on all of its previous wars combined. That has fundamentally changed our fiscal situation. That, combined with the deindustrialization of America, in which American-based corporations are moving manufacturing facilities abroad to take care, to take advantage of lower labor costs and laxer environmental conditions, plus the fact that many corporations, and this is true right here in the Silicon Valley, are taking increasing advantage of contract workers so they don't have to pay medical benefits. Sooner or later, these economic chickens are going to come home to roost. In recent weeks, I have read a very important article from the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle from October of this year, talking about how the Social Security and Medicare systems are going to be bankrupt, and that a worldwide financial crisis is in all probability going to sweep those, as well as people's 401k and pension programs before them. At some point, the economic chickens that Ronald Reagan and George Bush hatched are going to come home to roost, and when that happens, there's going to be an economic catastrophe and a resulting political crisis in the United States. We have also, in some of our conversations with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of the landmark book Emerging Viruses, subtitled AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, touched on a Council on Foreign Relations document, which I suspect provides the solution, and a very final solution it will be, to the looming economic Medicare and Social Security crunches, namely a recommendation to reduce the American population by 55% to the levels that it was in the late 1940s, namely somewhere between 120 and 140 million, that down from 260 million. Now, given the fact that people are going to be born during this period of time, what you're talking about is getting rid of a serious, serious number of people. And again, I suspect the economic chickens that are going to be coming home to roost will be comfortably housed by eliminating workers who don't have jobs and consumers who don't have adequate goods and services. I expect those elimination programs to begin somewhat along the lines they did in Germany, with the infirm, the disadvantaged, the old, the mentally ill, the people who are no longer considered useful laborers or workers, people who are gay, people who are drug users, the homeless will be among the first to go. Eventually, African Americans, Jews, people whose politics are considered too liberal, and that'll be anybody who's to the left of Newt Gingrich, will be done in as well. I know this will sound utterly incredible to the uninitiated. When people made similar warnings about what was going to happen in Germany, they were called crazy as well. It is in this context that I encourage members of the listening audience to pay a great deal of attention to the current debate raging in the United States about physician-assisted suicide. Bear in mind that the Nazi extermination programs began with their euthanasia program. We're going to talk about that in a minute. The Supreme Court this past week heard arguments about physician-assisted suicide. The San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, January 9th of 1997, among other newspapers, carried discussion of this. The following is a Chronicle News Service's story, Dateline Washington headline, "Most Justices Dubious About Assisted Suicide," subtitled, "Top Court Hears Assertion of Constitutional Right." The Supreme Court gave a cool and dubious reception yesterday to the argument that terminally ill patients have the right to commit suicide with a doctor's help. A decision by the court is not expected for months in the two assisted suicide cases argued yesterday, but skepticism voiced by most of the nine justices gave hope to opponents of the right to die that the court would rule states that states can continue to bar the practice of physician-assisted suicide. Quote, "Where should we draw the line?" unquote, asked Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of six justices to voice doubts about arguments against laws in New York and Washington State that banned assisted suicide. By the way, I would note, by way of underscoring the importance of a multiplicity of political viewpoints for a healthy democracy, that Justice Antonin Scalia, arguably the most reactionary Supreme Court justice and an individual for whom I have no use personally, has been one of the justices most vocal against the right to die issue. I also want to add very briefly that certainly I can understand why a terminally ill person running up large medical bills and in agony would want to be dispatched, and who knows if I were in that situation, I might feel the same way. The problem is that that opens a door which is very difficult to close, and just how difficult that can be was demonstrated by Nazi Germany and is also receiving concrete proof in terms of the difficulty of closing that door in the Netherlands today. The Netherlands are a very progressive and generally liberal country. With fascism being, as Mussolini said, and Mussolini was the first fascist and coined the term, with fascism being corporatism, and with the fascist state being the corporate state, ultimately the corporate tactic of applying cost-benefit analysis to the entity of human life will be, in my opinion, and it is a pessimistic opinion, the final arbiter with regard to the issue of physician-assisted suicide. This is not something that's receiving a lot of discussion in the political circles, certainly not in a so-called progressive political sector, and as always, note the use of the term so-called. It should. And I want to emphasize in the most emphatic terms for members of the listening audience that ultimately when the crunch comes, and I don't know whether it's going to be in 6 months or 30 years, ultimately many of your A blank blanks are going to be, in fact, I will say most of your A blank blanks are going to be directly involved in dealing with these particular issues. So this is not something which you are going to be unaffected by. Just imagine that 55% of the population is going to be reduced if the Council on Foreign Relations recommendations are met, and I bet they will be, by 55%. I suspect this process will be a gradual process. I also suspect that the media and also elements of the national security establishment, which will probably be involved in the elimination of them, will not be forthcoming about just what is going on. I think we can expect that there will be the same forces that are decrying the certainty that there was a conspiracy behind President Kennedy's assassination, the virtual certainty at this point that AIDS was deliberately created by fascist elements within ours and other countries' national security establishments, basically the NATO countries, the Christian West collaborating with each other. The same elements that have denied that are likely to deny the 55% reduction. Indeed, if this seems outlandish to people, just consider the book Emerging Viruses, consider RFA-16, consider the interview available from Spitfire with Drs. Horowitz, Cantwell, Nicholson, and Ed Haslam. The elimination of population groups deemed unnecessary or undesirable is already underway. I'm not talking about something that's going to happen in the future. With regard to euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, I want to note that that institution has been effected in the Netherlands, and it is proving much more difficult to close that door than some people had predicted. By the way, that last article is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, January 9th of 1997. The following is an editorial from the San Jose Mercury News, also of that same day, Thursday, January 9th, 1997, and a very important editorial. Actually, it's not an editorial. It's an op-ed column. This is by Joanne Jacobs, an editorial writer for the San Jose Mercury News, and she has penned a very important op-ed column indeed, and I'm going to read part of that to you. This, again, from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, January 9th of 1997, is entitled A Question of Death, subtitled, We must learn to ease the pain of dying Americans, but the dangers of a constitutional remedy are too great. And it quotes a part of the Hippocratic Oath, I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked. That Hippocratic Oath is what physicians are required to adhere to, and it has been changed, by the way, in American medical schools in a frightening way. Joanne Jacobs touches on that later on in the column, but of the abuse of the euthanasia law in the Netherlands, something that I think we can anticipate might very well happen in the United States, Joanne Jacobs writes, skipping down, in the Netherlands, euthanasia was legalized effectively by the court's refusal to convict physicians of euthanasia. It's, quote, euthanasia, unquote. If the doctor injects a lethal dose, it's, quote, physician-assisted suicide, unquote, if he prescribes a legal dose but doesn't administer it. The results are troubling. In Seduced by Death, U.S. psychiatrist Herbert Hendon argues that the Dutch have slid past every line. Quote, the Netherlands have moved from assisted suicide to euthanasia, from euthanasia for people who are terminally ill to euthanasia for those who are chronically ill, from euthanasia for physical illness to euthanasia for psychological distress, and from voluntary euthanasia to euthanasia. to involuntary euthanasia, unquote. One more time, that last paragraph, because it's a doozy. In Seduced by Death, U.S. psychiatrist Herbert Hendin, H-E-N-D-I-N, argues that the Dutch have slid past every line. The Netherlands have moved from assisted suicide to euthanasia, from euthanasia for people who are terminally ill to euthanasia for those who are chronically ill, from euthanasia for physical illness to euthanasia for psychological distress, and from voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia. And that is precisely the type of salami tactic, the gradual progression that euthanasia underwent in Nazi Germany, eventually leading to Auschwitz. Continuing with the Joanne Jacobs column, more than 1,000 people a year are killed without explicitly requesting death, according to a 1991 report by a government commission. Doctors said they acted usually after talking to family members because, quote, the family could no longer take it, unquote, 32%, or because of the patient's, quote, low quality of life, unquote, 31%. There are cases of physicians deciding on their own for competent patients that death is the best medicine. One doctor killed a dying nun, convinced she wanted an end to pain, but was barred from requesting death by her religious convictions. Now, just think for a minute, folks, in the event of an economic collapse, maybe 25 or 30 years down the line, with the baby boomers now old and no longer economically productive, no longer fitting into the ethic of corporatism, and all of those but the very rich dependent on the state for assistance or their relatives. And just imagine a more reactionary Supreme Court than the one we have now. And it remains to be seen what the contemporary Supreme Court rules. I think the pressure to eliminate those who are deemed undesirable, whether they're old, infirm, mentally ill, or whether perhaps they're just poor, homeless, black, gay, Jewish, or any of the other groups that were viewed as out-groups by the Third Reich and by the forces of international fascism, forces sadly not alien to the United States. Just imagine 20 or 30 years down the line what sorts of pressures might be exerted to eliminate unnecessary population with an economic collapse and resulting political catastrophe upon us. Continuing with the Joanne Jacobs column. That sort of thinking alarms some disabled Americans, including a group called Not Dead Yet, who don't want doctors deciding that their lives are not worth living or that they're too great a burden on others. Perhaps what's needed more than physician-assisted suicide is a change in habits and attitudes. It's clear patients want more dignity and less technology, but doctors are quick to order respirators or resuscitation, slow to boost pain medications, studies show. Patients' wishes are often ignored. That's encouraged the demand for assisted suicide. It's also encouraged the demand for hospice care designed to ease the pain of dying patients rather than prolong life. Suicide opponents say hospices are the answer, at least for the terminally ill. Most pain can be medicated. Advocates of the right to assisted suicide say it's a question of choice, not of medication. Physicians are split. Some want legal cover for their covert acts of mercy. Others do not want to be the angels of life and death. What about the Hippocratic Oath? Now, check this last part. This is fascinating. Almost all medical schools use a version of the oath, but a version rewritten for modern times. Only 14% ask young doctors to swear to, quote, give no deadly medicine, unquote. Only 3% include Hippocrates' ban on sex with patients. That's a fascinating bit of metamorphosis in the Hippocratic Oath, and I can't say it's one that makes me inclines me to do the varsity rag. That, again, a Joanne Jacobs op-ed column from the San Jose Mercury News of Thursday, January 9th of 1997. One of the things that I've spoken about in the very important miscellaneous archive show, Euthanasia in Contemporary Germany and in Contemporary America and Nazi Germany, Freudian slip there, is the fact that the Third Reich's extermination programs grew directly out of their euthanasia program, which in turn was the outgrowth of the international mental hygiene and international eugenics movements. There is a new book out about the Nazi euthanasia program. It's entitled Death and Deliverance, subtitled Euthanasia in Germany, 1900 to 1945. It's authored by Michael Burley, B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H, and published in softcover by the Cambridge University Press. Actually, it's not a new book. It's copyrighted 1994. Okay, so this has been out for a while. Research credit on this book, by the way, goes to a listener who found it and purchased it for me. A tip of the hat to that listener. Again, this is Death and Deliverance, Euthanasia in Germany, 1900 through 45, Michael Burley. In this book, there's a discussion of the T4 or Tiergartenstrasse 4 program. Tiergartenstrasse 4 was the building in Berlin at which the Nazi euthanasia program was headquartered. And I'm going to describe here the beginnings of the Nazi euthanasia program, which in turn was the beginning of the Third Reich's extermination programs leading to Auschwitz, Treblinka, Bergen-Belsen, etc. Bear in mind that the Third Reich's racial legislation, which led to these programs, was the outgrowth of international eugenics thinking and legislation, which had a profound influence in the United States, and the American eugenicists had a profound influence on their Nazi counterparts. In Chapter 3, entitled Wheels Must Roll for Victory, Children's Euthanasia and Action T4, we read, in the winter of 1938 and 39, the parents of a malformed infant called Nauer, that's K-N-A-U-E-R, petitioned Hitler in order to bring about its death. The child's grandmother had encouraged them to do so. This was probably not an isolated incident. In such a political climate, understandable human anxieties about severely disabled infants, terminal illness, and severe incapacity were compounded by grassroots ideological fanaticism. Requests for, quote, euthanasia, unquote, were also received from a middle-aged woman dying of cancer and from a labor service official who had been blinded and severely injured after falling into a cement mixer. Petitions to Hitler were dealt with by a subdepartment of the Kanzlei der Führer, the Chancellor of the Führer, or KdF, or KdF, an agency originally established to project Hitler as a leader who listened to the complaints and requests of plain party members. From 1934 onwards, the KdF was led by Reichsleiter Philipp Bühler, B-O-U-H-L-E-R. He was a Munich-born Nazi old fighter with literary pretensions, blessed with an attractive wife and the well-fed, instantly forgettable features of a thrusting middle manager of a self-satisfied assistant professor. During the 1930s, the KdF retained its populist remit, branching out from, quote, party comrades, unquote, to national comrades, unquote, in general, which it used to extend its influence into normative areas of government, such as pardons granted by the Ministry of Justice. It hired more personnel and spawned a series of main offices. Main Office 11, under Oberdienstleiter Victor Brock, B-R-A-C-K, and his deputy Werner Blachenburg, B-L-A-C-K-E-N-B-U-R-G, dealt with affairs relating to party and state. Subdepartment 11B, under Hans Heffelmann, H-E-F-E-L-M-A-N-N, was specifically responsible for handling petitions to Hitler. According to Heffelmann, about 2,000 petitions arrived each day. The job of Subdepartment 11B was to settle ordinary people's problems with state or party agencies in an informal and unbureaucratic way. That last quality, and the type of requests that flowed its way, ensured Bühler's agency the leading role it played in the euthanasia program. The exact origins of the euthanasia program are complex, there being several versions of how it started. Depending on one's intellectual predilections, one can stress the importance of Hitler ideology or bureaucratic ambition. The doctor attending Hitler's retinue, Professor Karl Rudolf Brandt, who having patched up Hitler's adjutant and niece after a car accident, was kept on hand to give medical attention after possible assassination attempts, testified at Nuremberg as to what happened to the Nauer child. Brandt, the father of a deformed child approached the Führer and asked that this child or this creature should be killed. Hitler turned this matter over to me and told me to go to Leipzig immediately, it was in Leipzig, to confirm the fact on the spot. It was a child which had been born blind, an idiot, at least it seemed to be an idiot, and it lacked one leg and part of an arm. By the way, interrupting, as I noted in January of 1995, there is now a similar case before the American courts, that's the Nguyen case, spelled N-G-U-Y-E-N, in which a poor couple, I guess he's a Vietnamese immigrant and she's a Native American, had a horribly deformed child, or a seriously deformed child, I should say, and the child, the parents wanted to keep the child, but because they're on welfare, The doctors want to put it to sleep because they say it would be too difficult to care for. So it's similar to the Naur case, except even more sinister, because here the parents want to keep the child alive, but the doctors want to put it to sleep. This case now before the American courts. So again, for people that think that my discussions of the Naur case are irrelevant or absurd or useless, just bear in mind that it was with the Naur case, that we're going to continue with in a second, that the legal door to state-authorized killing was authorized in the Third Reich, and there is just such a case before the American courts. Returning now to Death and Deliverance, Euthanasia in Germany, 1900 through 1945, by Michael Burley, we read, question, again, this from the interrogation of Dr. Braun at Nuremberg. Question, witness, you were speaking about the Leipzig affair, about this deformed child. What did Hitler order you to do? Braun, he ordered me to talk to the physicians who were looking after the child to find out whether the statements of the father were true. If they were correct, then I was to inform the physicians in his name that they could carry out euthanasia. The important thing was that the parents should not feel themselves incriminated at some later date as a result of this euthanasia, that the parents should not have the impression that they themselves were responsible for the death of this child. I was further ordered to state that if these physicians should become involved in some legal proceedings because of this matter, these proceedings would be quashed by order of Hitler. Martin Bormann was ordered at the time to inform Gürtner, the Minister of Justice, accordingly about this case. That's Gürtner. Question, what did the doctors who were involved say? Braunt, the doctors were of the opinion that there was no justification for keeping such a child alive. It was pointed out that in maternity wards under certain circumstances, it is quite natural for the doctors themselves to perform euthanasia in such a case without anything further being said about it. No precise instructions were given in that respect. Question, was this problem of deformities dealt with anywhere else? Braunt, the problem of deformities was probably discussed before this Leipzig case, first of all by the Ministry of the Interior. In this case, Dr. Linden participated as a special consultant, probably as representative of Dr. Conti, C-O-N-T-I, who became Reich Minister for Health after the death of his predecessor, Wagner, and then afterwards State Secretary in the Ministry of the Interior. And then the author Burley goes on to comment, the object of this high-level solicitude had been brought to the University of Leipzig Pediatric Clinic, whose director was Professor Werner Cattell. Recalling the course of events in 1962, Cattell said he had discussed the case with the father, who, concerned about the effect the child was having on his wife's state of mind, had requested its admission to the clinic with a view to, quote, putting it to sleep, unquote. Bear this in mind. Now, again, this is the Naur case that I've spoken about so many times in the past, and this was the case which opened the legal loophole or the legal door in Germany for official state-authorized killing. Now, talking again about the euthanasia program in the Netherlands, and just such a program is to a certain extent under contemplation by the American courts, returning again to the Joanne Jacobs column from the Mercury News of 1997, in Seduced by Death, U.S. psychiatrist Herbert Hendon argues that the Dutch have slid past every line. The Netherlands have moved from, the Netherlands have moved from assisted suicide to euthanasia, from euthanasia for people who are terminally ill to euthanasia for those who are chronically ill, from euthanasia for physical illness to euthanasia for psychological distress, and from voluntary euthanasia to involuntary euthanasia. More than 1,000 people a year are killed without explicitly requesting death, according to a 1991 report by a government commission. Doctors said they acted, usually after talking to family members, because, quote, the family could no longer take it, unquote, 32%, or because of the patient's, quote, low quality of life, unquote, 31%. Just that same rationale has been cited by Dr. Kevorkian and the Doctor of Death as reason to dispose of, quote, high quads, unquote. In other words, quadriplegics with an injury high up on the spinal cord. So again, the relevance of this passage. Recalling the course of events in 1962, Cattell said he had discussed the case with a father who, concerned about the effect the child was having on his wife's state of mind, had requested its admission to the clinic with a view to, quote, putting it to sleep, unquote. Cattell had then gone on holiday. When he returned, he was informed that one of his subordinates, a Dr. Cole, had given the child a lethal injection while the nurses were taking a coffee break. Cattell's memory then went strategically blank
until he recalled a strange series of events in the autumn of 1940, which, if nothing else, suggests he had a fertile imagination. A baby chimpanzee was born in the Leipzig Zoo, whose mother died 9 days after giving birth. Cattell took the ape into his clinic, feeding it with human milk on a veranda. This profligacy with precious resources allegedly resulted in charges of being a, quote, parasite on the people, unquote, and the intervention of the senior mayor of Leipzig. The latter suggested to Cattell that he might like to accept a post as an expert referee on the newly formed Reich Committee for the Combating of Serious Congenital and Hereditary Illnesses. Having discussed the matter with an elderly academic mentor, Cattell resolved to accept in order to prevent, quote, euthanasia, unquote, falling into, quote, illegitimate and radical hands, unquote. Both Brandt and Cattell stressed the crucial importance of the Naur case, not surprisingly given the element of explicit consensuality and the implication that the relevant policies evolved ad hoc. That concludes this segment. That's all we have time for. This discussion will be continued in the next half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.